Middays, we're live. By the way, we were just talking about Speaker of the House Mike Johnson and Thomas Massie indicating this morning behind closed doors and then disclosing to the press, yep, I'm about to make a motion to get rid of the Speaker. Just passing the wire now, Rhino, the Speaker says he will not resign under pressure. He was just questioned at the podium, little press briefing, says, I ain't going anywhere. Come after me. Man, what a crazy deal we got going on. But we welcome now Aaron Rice, director of the Mississippi Justice Institute. Aaron, good to see you.
Hey, Gerard. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we were just talking about the chaos that is occurring in the halls of the United States Capitol, the center of democracy. Mm-hmm. We're watching it play out, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's quite dysfunctional for sure.
Golly. I just don't know. I don't know where it's going, and this is particularly disturbing given that this is election year. We're a short 7 months away.
Absolutely.
From going to the polls and electing our members of Congress and a number of key races in the U.S. Senate as well. But I believe that this sort of dysfunction and in this just this chaos and consternation negatively impacts the Republican Party. What do you think?
I absolutely agree with that. I mean, as you know, Gerard, I was just recently elected as the chairman of the Madison County Republican Executive Committee, so I'm kind of working on the ground right now in elections. We just had, as you know, our primary election, both for, you know, presidential primary and for the Senate and House seats. And yep. We also had a runoff election on April 12th in Madison County that I was involved in. And it's a lot of work doing all of that. And so, you know, when you're involved down at the grassroots level, helping with elections and trying to get people out to vote and all of that, you notice this stuff in a different way. And it's just like you said. I mean, I totally agree with you that I think this kind of dysfunction in the House, you know, in the Republican caucus is not good for the party. And particularly, you know, what strikes me about it is having this level of disagreement on international affairs in particular. You know, you would think that that there might be, you know, disagreement on social policy and things like that, and maybe some gridlock that we can't get past. But on fundamental issues, even like I said, with international affairs, to be you know, that gridlocked in our party, I do think it hurts us. And I hope that, you know, we were talking off air, this has actually been going on for quite a long time. This is not new. I mean, if you go back to the John Boehner days, there's been, you know, a lot of disagreement in the party and a lot of efforts, particularly in the House, to change leadership and all of that. And so, but I do think it would be in the best interest of the party for us to be able to pull together a little more and to unify more, for sure, especially like you said, in an election year.
You make a point that I really hadn't considered, Aaron, but I think it's a good one, which is all of this dispute, all of this conflict is over foreign affairs, international policy. When you speak of, when you think about funding for Ukraine, for Israel, I mean, I guess you could put the border situation in that bucket as well. That really ought to be more of a domestic issue. But normally, we're arguing over critical economic policy.
Yeah,
that's where the delta typically is. But in this case, that is not what the center of the disputes are about.
Yeah.
I think we have to include in there this lack of regular order in passing spending bills that fund the discretionary component of government. That's sort of fair to say that's what got it all cranked up. That's
absolutely
what they got all mad at Speaker McCarthy about. And I personally would like to see us return to regular order.
Yeah.
That's the way it ought to work.
I absolutely agree. I mean, we absolutely should have regular order. And I think folks are you know, completely right to be upset that we don't. And, you know, I'm like you. I think you may have said, you know, I'm not, you know, to be honest, entirely sure what all the hang-ups or the obstacles are to getting back to that. But it's like you said. I mean, I know that, you know, the current speaker, you know, Mike Johnson, wanted to get back to that. And you know, apparently it's a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
And it's like you said, with all this gridlock and with people not being able to agree, it's difficult to accomplish anything.
Yeah.
And so I know he wants to, and if he isn't able to right now, I'm not sure if anybody can get us back to that right now.
Well, I agree. And, you know, you could go, I guess, I thought Speaker Johnson would be a person that is typically viewed as very conservative and skewed fairly far to the right,
mm-hmm.
but that doesn't seem to be the perspective of those who are looking to kick him out,
yeah.
such as Tallahassee and Marjorie Taylor Greene, and some others, as you know, just called it quits, said, I'm out of here. Gallagher's won. There's been some response from Representative Chip Roy, Ralph Norman, Bob Good. These are all Freedom Caucus members that all said they don't like the way things are going there, so this is disappointing to them. They think it's disappointing to Americans, sounding more towards the leaning towards needing to make a change, supporting a change.
Yeah. It does seem like a very difficult position for any speaker to be in at this point, with as easy, you know, as it is to call a vote on that and to force a speaker out. And it's like we said, I mean, this has actually been an issue going all the way back to John Boehner. So, you know, I know that it seems like, I think you said earlier today, it's going to be difficult to find somebody who wants to be the speaker at this point.
It's crazy.
Yeah. It's going to be tough. And, you know, you were more prescient than I was on it, I think. I think when I saw that Mike Johnson was selected as the speaker, I'm not saying that I thought he could, you know, just, you know, mend all wounds. But I did think that if there was anybody in the caucus that could kind of bridge that divide. I just, you know, you were saying it earlier that he was viewed as, you know, very conservative. I think that he had appeal to, you know, some of the more national conservative types, as well as a lot of the, you know, older traditional Republican types. I mean, you know, if you look at his record and his policy views, there's a lot for everyone to like there. And so I actually thought, well, maybe he's the guy that can kind of hold everybody together, but obviously, like you said, that's not turning out to be the case. It doesn't look like.
You know, I don't really think his policy positions are that much different, if at all, with the prior speaker, Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah.
That's not the issue. The issue
yeah.
isn't the policy positions. The issue is how do you coalesce this large group, 217 people, around these policies so that you can actually move them forward.
Yeah.
And that seems to be just lacking, I guess.
So it does. And what strikes me, too, is that it seems like, you know, everything has turned into the 24-hour news cycle and everybody wants their 15 minutes of fame. And,
yeah.
you know, we elect people who are up there, you know, sometimes not necessarily to solve problems, but to complain about problems and to kind of be in the spotlight. And so I think that makes it more difficult, too.
I agree. Well, we'll see where all this goes. It's just disturbing that this is happening within 7 months of Election Day. And, of course, we got every House member on the ballot across the country, as well as a number of key Senate races. And, man, sure would like to see the Senate flip. But what's bothering me, I don't know if you've seen this or not, Aaron, is that if you look at those key, the top, most contentious races where the Republicans have a shot at flipping, the fundraising, the Democrats are just lapping the Republicans here in these various states. I'll give you an example. In Arizona, you know, Kirsten Sinema, the independent, is not running for re-election. So what I should say is that running for the seat is Representative Ruben Gallego. I'm not sure if I pronounced that right. He has raised $7.5 million, has $9.6 million on hand. Carrie Lake, who, of course, ran for governor of Arizona, endorsed by Donald Trump, she's got half that much.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got Michigan, Montana, Senator John Tester. I've never understood this one. I mean, he's a Democrat, normally caucuses with the Democrats in a red state of Montana. He's got $12.7 million on hand.
Wow.
And is being in the general challenge by a Republican who also has President Trump's endorsement. He's got $3 million, and that includes $500,000 he loaned to the campaign.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I had not heard those numbers, but that's not good news for sure. I mean, Republicans are going to need to pick it up around the country, especially in those highly contested races.
Man. Pennsylvania, Senator Bob Casey, man, would I ever like to see him get replaced, being challenged by Republican Dave McCormick, who is a business person. McCormick has $5.5 million. Casey has $12 million.
Wow.
Double.
Yeah.
It's just hard. It's hard to win
it
on
is.
That basis.
Yeah.
We're
yeah.
coming right back. We've got Aaron Rice from the Mississippi Justice Institute. We're going to dig into some of the stuff going on here back home in Mississippi in the next segment. Stay with us. With Aaron Rice, director of the Mississippi Justice Institute. So I think we've hashed out what's going on at the federal level. I will say this, teased this yesterday a bit. You know, I like to study economic policy and tax policy and kind of have a passion for that. Of all the public policy, that's what I like to focus on more than anything.
Yeah.
Well, we got the president today in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And he's going to be pitching his tax plans, and he's going to once again tell the American people that the rich don't pay their fair share, and we got to punish those dirty, greedy corporations. You know, they make money. We can't allow that. We got to take it all. And he's going to be not only pitching his tax plans, his future tax plans, but he's going to be trying to persuade those in attendance that his economic policies have made their lives better.
That's a tough sell for sure. Whew,
that's going to be tough. But I'm curious as to see what those remarks will consist of. But those who follow that sort of stuff for a living at the national level, this is what they're saying we can expect.
Yeah. Well, the tax policy is interesting to me, too, because I haven't seen the proposal yet. But, you know, and I know you know, if you actually look at the, especially if you're just talking about federal income tax, the rates there, they're so progressive to begin with. And so, you know, it's almost hard to imagine, you know, how much more progressive can we get with this? I mean, a lot of Americans.
Most in the world.
Yes. And lots of Americans are paying effectively negative, you know, income tax rates as it is. And so, you know, again, just what you're saying, the whole, you know, the rich don't pay their fair share. I mean, if you actually look at it, they're paying the vast bulk of for the federal government. And so it would be interesting to see, you know, how much more progressive do you think we can get on it?
Top 1% account for about 22% of the total adjusted gross income.
Yeah.
However, they pay 46% of the taxes.
Yeah.
So I'd like to know what they have deemed as a fair share.
Yeah.
I don't see how it could be any more fair in their, and certainly in their eyes, which is the rich just need to pay it all. It's pretty much where we are. I don't know if you're familiar with this statistic, but the top 10% pay 97.5% of total taxes.
I have seen that.
Pardon me, the top 50%.
Yeah.
Top 50% pay 97.5%. The bottom 50% pay 2.5%.
Yeah. Yep.
But that's not considered fair.
And that's exactly what I was saying. We have such a progressive tax code as it is.
It is.
So when you hear this, you know, oh, they're not paying their fair share. Just like you said, what is a fair share then? I'd like to see it.
Well, this is going to be front and center, as you well know, when we get a new Congress, because the individual provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, also known as the Trump tax cuts, expire at the end of 25. You're not hearing a lot of discussion about this because we're all focused on Israel, Ukraine, and the border, and I certainly understand that. But there's no doubt in my mind that this is going to be front and center when we get a new Congress in 2025, hopefully a new president, and this is going to suck all the air out of the room. They're going to be debating and arguing over this. And what folks need to know is if nothing happens, then all of those provisions expire and we revert to the tax system we had in place under Barack Obama before Trump was elected. It means your taxes are going up, is what it means.
Absolutely. And you know, I know I'm preaching to the choir here to both you and your audience, but what you always wonder is, you know, when are these guys going to get the message that what we need to do is cut spending? You know, I mean, we need to stop thinking of, you know, how much more we can tax folks. We've got to look at the other side of that and reduce our federal spending.
Unbelievable. All right, let's turn our attention to state political affairs, government affairs. You know that we're on the cusp of maybe ending the session here. It's the first session of a new term. Thus, it is extended for, what, 30 days or so? Yeah. So they're still down there deliberating.
May 5th, I think, is
I think that's right. Yeah. So we've seen lots of high profile. We've talked about it on the program many times. I know you track this as well. Lots of very high profile measures that just don't seem to be getting agreement between the two houses, and it looks like we might not get a great deal done.
Yeah, it's you know, there's been a lot of ink spilled recently just about kind of the fact that it's, I think there were very high hopes for this session too. You know, there were a lot of proposals out there. Some of them were, you know, real game changers, and there seemed to be an appetite to go after real policy changes. And it's like you said, I mean, getting towards the end here, of course, we don't know for sure, you know, until the legislators go home, you never know what's going to happen. But I agree with you, just kind of any hallmark achievement is seems unlikely at this point.
Yeah, just thinking through all the major legislation, we started out with robust legislation to really phase in universal school choice. I mean, this has been attempted for every session that I can remember.
Yep.
And we just can't seem to get it, but we got it out of the House this year.
Yep.
We had kind of a change in leadership there, a new speaker, a new committee chair and so forth. Got it out of the House, got over to the Senate, and it didn't get really any attention whatsoever.
That's right, so. That's right. And I guess you can, you know, take comfort in just getting closer to the goalpost a little bit and continuing to push those things. But you're right. At the end of the day, it either becomes law or it doesn't. And it didn't really get close this time.
So I think we're going to just study it is the latest outcome of that. We're going to go study the matter. But, you know, the walls are closing in on us from our neighboring states. Alabama just passed sweeping universal choice legislation.
Absolutely. And you've got it in a lot of states, too, you know. And like you said, I mean, Louisiana, you know, on our, you know, other border, and then Tennessee has it, and you know, of course, you've got Florida, and just all kind of states are very interested in this now. And I agree with you. I mean, there's going to come a point where people say, why can't we have that? It's clearly working in other states. Why can't we do that here?
Arkansas, one of the top priorities for newly minted Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and got that done in short order
right
after she took office.
That's right.
Remember that?
I think I said Louisiana, and I meant Arkansas.
But Louisiana already has a fair amount of school choice,
right.
They're not quite at the universal level yet.
Absolutely. Arkansas is a great example to look to. And, you know, I mean, it'll if nothing else during this, you know, study period that we have, we can look at the results out of Arkansas.
Yeah. But the ballot initiative, you know, this is something that, once again, got a false start in that it passed the House. A resolution, of course, to put it on the ballot for the people to ratify, to reinstate some sort of citizen-initiated ballot measure process. But over there in the Senate, they just had a different idea about that.
Yeah. And you know, as I recall, the proposal that was there dealt with a lot of the objections, and some of which were valid objections to, you know, any kind of ballot initiative process. So as I recall, I mean, it would have limited it to statutes, which, of course, you know, when you see how it works and if there's problems, the legislature after a period of time could revisit that.
Yep.
And, you know, and I think it had some pretty high, you know, maybe supermajority requirement for the legislature to override it or to change it. But, you know, my point is that there were a lot of things in there that you would think would have taken care of those objections, and yet it didn't go anywhere.
The House was amenable to a higher signature threshold.
Yep.
It went over to the Senate. They wanted even higher.
Yeah.
And then Senator Parker amended it to increase or stipulate that 67% of all those who voted in an election where a measure was on the ballot would have to vote for the measure, either yay or nay. And then 67% yays would be required for the measure to pass.
Yeah.
So it significantly upped the thresholds there. And at this point, that's not going anywhere.
Yeah. So. And you do wonder at some point, you know, something's either got to happen or the legislature has to admit they just don't want it, because this has been several years now. And we all know that went away from kind of a technicality. And so for the legislature to, you know, continue proclaiming that they want to, you know, reinstate that right, but then just let it die every year, at some point, you know, they either need to do it or admit they don't want to do it.
Education funding,
yep.
Another hot potato issue. We've got, again, very competing views on that from the House and the Senate. The Inspire Act came out of the House, would have completely revamped, overhauled the education funding formula. Over in the Senate, it was more about just making some adjustments to the existing Byzantine, I think is one way to describe MAEP formula.
And that's an odd one, too, because you would have thought, I would have thought people could have agreed on the Inspire bill, totally. And so for that to meet its demise was very surprising.
Very surprising. If you can hang around, we can continue
absolutely
the discussion. We got Aaron Rice, director of the Mississippi Justice Institute. Want to find out what you guys are up to
absolutely
at the Justice Institute as well. Coming right back in the Element Well studio. We're visiting with Aaron Rice, director of the Mississippi Justice Institute. So we've talked about some of the high-profile measures, legislation that has been traversing its way through the Capitol there. Another one I'll just end with, and then I'll ask you to talk about what you guys at the Justice Institute have been tracking and what you're up to. And that's something that's I focus on a lot, which is the public employees retirement system, PERS. I called it in the article the elephant in the room. That's because it's pretty obvious here. We got to do something, and nobody seems to be talking about it. But the House, of course, introduced a bill that would restructure the board from its current composition and would move away from elected members that are elected by the PERS membership. Talking about elected board members, to one in which 7 of the 11 would be appointed, 4 by the governor, 3 by the lieutenant governor. That's seen as effectively sort of taking that away from the control of the members and politicizing the board, et cetera. That gets down to the Senate. You know, the Senator Johnson didn't even put it on the floor in the committee meeting. He didn't have the votes. He told me that before he even conducted the meeting. And now the latest is Senator Parker introduced an amendment into another measure which would first cancel the scheduled employer contribution rate increase and then also strip that power away from the PERS board. And where we are today is it looks like nothing's going to happen again.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it should, you know, that power should be moved because – you know, the objections about at the time to that bill that would have, you know, the governor appoint and the lieutenant governor appoint was, oh, no, it's going to be politicized. And we want people who, you know, are actually accountable to the, you know, the PERS members. But, I mean, that makes no sense because, you know, the membership themselves, I mean, this is coming from tax funds. That's where the funds come from. So taxpayers should be represented in that process. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just like you said, for it to die with you know, no resolution to that issue, it's not going to fix itself.
It's not going away. And, of course, I think there's a perception, a misconception that the PERS membership has, which is we don't need to let this happen. It would turn control over to lawmakers. Lawmakers have control now.
Yeah.
They could vote on a measure tomorrow that just ends the board, honestly. I mean, they have full control. They created it. They established it.
Yep.
And it is an instrument of the law, of the state.
It's a delegation of power is what it is. And if the legislature, you know, delegates power, they can take that power back away.
Yeah. But on the other hand, the PERS members, they also object on the basis that they are taxpayers as well. This is a common retort. Well, it's true. They are, and I respect that and understand that, but there are roughly 2 million taxpayers in the state of Mississippi, so we got 300,000 in PERS. And I know they'll say, well, we got family members, and I respect that.
Yeah.
But there's a whole other big group of non-PERS taxpayers.
Well, exactly. And, I mean, you have to admit that if you're a recipient, you know, the amount you're losing in taxes and the amount you're gaining in benefits, I mean, it's, you know, you're gaining way more. And so you're never going to be personally incentivized, and even factoring in family, friends, all that, you know, to look at it from an objective standpoint. And look, I'm not saying that there shouldn't be representation on that board for, you know, PERS beneficiaries, but what I am saying is it shouldn't be, you know, exclusively made up of people elected by PERS beneficiaries. There should be some other accountability, you know, for people who are solely taxpayers and not beneficiaries should, you know, have some input into that process as well.
Seems like that would be a reasonable compromise. And if Senator Parker's bill were to go through, or his amendment in another bill were to go through, the PERS board would be fairly impotent. I mean, wouldn't have a great deal of power. Right now, they can raise the employer rate. If the legislature removes that power away from them, that about the only thing they could do is typical corporate governance. They can decide who to hire to help run the fund, and they set the target return rate. Mm-hmm. Pretty much ends there, honestly.
Yep. And you know, there's probably a lot to be done there. You know, and for whoever they pick as an executive director, you know, choosing what to invest the funds in and all of that, there's probably a lot to do. But like you said, structurally, and when it comes to the big things that can either make or break this process, that would be in the hands of the legislature and not the board.
Yeah, it should be. Yeah. I mean, that's who we elect to make our laws.
Absolutely.
So. All right, so let's talk about what's going on at the Mississippi Justice Institute.
Yeah. Well, the last several months really have been really busy with a case that you followed closely all along, our Certificate of Need case. That is pending a decision from the judge right now. And so we completed the discovery phase of the litigation is what that's called. So we had a lot of testimony we took. And of course, throughout the process, we'd been doing that and collecting documents and all of that. But all that evidence is in. It was in at the beginning of this year. And so what we did was all the parties filed briefs with the judge, legal arguments, making our case. You know, we made our case on behalf of our client, the plaintiff in the case, of why we believe the certificate of need laws that apply to him should be struck down. And so all of that is done. It's in front of the judge now. It's in his hands, and we're awaiting his decision. And so I feel very confident about it. I think that we had very good arguments. I think that the evidence in the case came in very strongly for us and really rebutted a lot of the arguments that the state wanted to put forward. And so really, again, we're just waiting on that, but I feel very good about it. And separately from that, kind of right before that certificate of need case, we were spent a lot of time working on our abortion case. And so, you know, the Arizona Supreme Court case that just came out recently and basically said that their very old law that had prohibited abortion was still good law now that, you know, that Dobbs had gotten rid of Roe v. Wade. And it's kind of a similar thing here, except kind of in reverse. So we have an old Mississippi Supreme Court opinion that says the opposite. It says that that abortion is a state constitutional right. And so even though Dobbs got rid of Roe v. Wade, we still have this Mississippi Supreme Court case that says that abortion is a state constitutional right, which is in conflict with the statute that our state legislature passed that now says, you know, elective abortion is illegal in Mississippi. And so we filed a lawsuit on behalf of some pro-life obstetricians and gynecologists seeking to clarify that. And ultimately, it will be before the Mississippi Supreme Court. We're same posture there. We're waiting for a ruling from the trial court judge. But ultimately, that will have to be appealed to the Mississippi Supreme Court for them to make a decision on what I ultimately believe they would do is overrule their prior precedent and say we were wrong to have held that. Abortion has never been a right protected by the Mississippi Constitution, our state constitution, not the federal U.S. Constitution. It's never been a right protected by the Mississippi Constitution, and because it's also not protected under the federal Constitution anymore, you know, the statute, the trigger law that Mississippi passed is valid and enforceable. And so that's what I think, where that will go.
Well, and then what about any involvement, your organization, in this Mifepristone so-called abortion pill that looks like making its way through the Supreme Court?
Absolutely. We're not. I've been watching that case closely. It actually involves the client that we are representing. It's the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. We're representing them in our case here in Mississippi, and they're actually one of the plaintiffs in that case as well. And so I watch it for a lot of different reasons. But no, we're not actively involved in it. We're just kind of monitoring that litigation and particularly for any impacts that it might have on ours. You have a lot of, you know, similar questions that get raised in other litigation, and so you kind of monitor to see what comes out of various courts. But that has you know, went through the Fifth Circuit and up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's been, you know, moving pretty quickly and you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's also litigation around abortion about EMTALA, which is, you know, the Biden administration tried to say, basically what you have here in both of these cases is the Biden administration in response to the Dobbs case. One thing they did was with that medication, got the FDA to get rid of the in-person dispensing requirements so that it could be mailed and you didn't have to, you know, see a doctor to get it. And then they tried to tell states that, you know, even in states where abortion is prohibited, we're going to require federal, you know, federally funded hospitals like VA centers. We believe there's a federal statute called EMTALA that basically says hospitals that provide emergency care and receive federal funds must treat any patient regardless of their ability to pay.
Right.
And you know, the Biden administration was saying that includes abortion. So if somebody shows up and needs an abortion in a state where it's outlawed, say at a VA here in Mississippi, that VA must provide it. And so there's litigation around that. So you're seeing, you know, kind of these peripheral battles that are now being fought on, you know, where do these lines get drawn?
Yeah, I'm not buying that you could apply EMTALA there.
Absolutely
That's not what the original
That's not what it means. It's absolutely not what it means. And it was actually very clear that it was not intended to override state law on issues like that. So that litigation will not go the direction that the Biden administration wants it to. Mm.
Well, I'm sure there'll be even more stuff come up.
Oh, absolutely.
We got to go, but I think we're going to see some challenges to all these various bans on transgender
procedures.
And
there are some of those already that are being litigated. Yep.
Aaron, good to see you. Appreciate you coming in.
Yep. Good seeing you, Gerard. Thanks for having me.
Coming right back, folks, in the Element Well Studio, Senator Juan Barnett at 12:05.